Welcome to the Impossible Network, the podcast about everyday people living extraordinary lives, how their upbringing affected them, how creativity fueled them, and how serendipity guided them.
And I found that in my own journey, I guess, when I got really into mindfulness, I'd be doing a lot of different kinds of meditations and I have all these insights. And the thing is that insights are thoughts and they evaporate. So what I started doing is taking these insights and actually figuring out a way to plug them into the things that I was working on. How does this insight affect my life right now? And that's really what the bullet journal method is all about, is taking the insights, the things that we learn, and putting them into action. And as you said, thereby aligning your actions with your beliefs to live a more intentional life. But we can get back to the Nietzsche quote if you want.
Today's guest is Ryder Carroll, the creator of the bullet journal method, or Bujo for short, and author of the recent bullet journal book. Ryder, a digital product designer by trade, was diagnosed with ADD, learning disabilities, early in life. This forced him to figure out alternative ways to be focused and productive. Through years of trial and error, he developed a methodology that went far beyond simple organization. Now, he focuses on helping others learn what the bullet journal method is truly about, the art of intentional living. In this episode, we discuss his serendipitous journey to the bullet journal, the method, the practice, and the underlying why of bullet journaling. We also discuss gratitude, contentment, meaning, curiosity, creativity, passion, persistence, and work ethic. And of course, we also ask his impossible advice. Towards the end of the interview, Ryder kindly agrees to extend to allow me to ask some questions I was just dying to ask. I hope you enjoy this existential episode with Ryder Carroll. Well, good morning, Ryder. Welcome to the Impossible Network. It's great to meet you at last.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Well, I'd like to kick off, like I do in all the other interviews, is really just start with your childhood, your upbringing, how your early years influenced your journey. I do know that you moved to the US when you were 18 and you were born in Austria, but that's about as much as I've been able to discover. So maybe you could just expand a little bit on your early years.
Certainly. I guess one thing that's interesting is that I went to the same school pretty much from elementary school through high school. It was just one building or a bunch of buildings that were cobbled together. And my parents were both teachers at the school. My mother was a middle school teacher and my father a high school teacher, high school English teacher. And it was an international school, so I was also exposed to a lot of different nationalities and ways of thinking, which was really kind of a blessing, right?
So your parents aren't Austrian?
They are not.
No. Oh, they're not? They're American?
They are.
Ah, right. Okay, that puts context in it. Okay. And yeah. What took them to Austria?
That's kind of a long story, but the short version is that when my parents got married, my mother gave my father one condition when he proposed, which was that they live abroad. And then as soon as they were able to do that, my father started looking for teaching locations because they were both teachers at the time. And there were three options available and Vienna was one of them. And they moved there and they fell in love and that was that.
Excellent. So the lottery of where your father got a job could have determined definitely your upbringing.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. Vienna versus Vladivostok could have been quite different. Mm-hmm. Okay. You were diagnosed at an early age with ADD. And just for context, I mean, there is a difference between ADD and ADHD, which I believe ADHD has more hyperactivity in it.
Well, I think as people have become more familiar with the condition, they've been able to focus in on variations of it. Back in the day, there was only one, so I can only speak to that.
Okay, so what age were you actually diagnosed?
I'm not entirely sure, but I would say that it became very apparent that I wasn't able to keep up as I got older. So because I was in the same school from kindergarten to senior year, at first when you're in school, your assignments are naps and drawing, and everybody's similarly is about as gifted as each other in those fields. But soon when you start actually doing actual work, then all of a sudden it becomes very clear when somebody struggles with something. And right from the beginning, I had challenges, especially with math and things that would require memorization of numbers. And that would intensify over time until it got to a point where it was a real problem and my parents were trying to figure out what was going on. But it wasn't until one of my teachers, actually a German teacher, made a distinction between me being just stupid and me actually having a specific challenge. I mean, she thought it was dyslexia. She was a German teacher, actually, which was interesting. But she noticed that I wasn't just bad at everything. There were specific things that I was tripping up on over and over again. And surfacing that was kind of the beginning, because then my parents realized, like, oh, okay, you know, that makes sense. Them both being teachers and having experienced kids with specific problems as well, or challenges, helped them start to, I guess, launch an investigation. Right. And that led to the diagnosis eventually, where they figured out what I was good at and what I wasn't good at. And that was really helpful information to have, even though getting a diagnosis that you do have some kind of learning disability is always challenging. But it was the beginning of the road.
And what type of treatment did they, or how did the teachers have embrace it before you started taking it on yourself to develop a methodology to address it?
Well, back then, there weren't a lot of ways to address it. You would address it as you would most other learning disabilities, right? More time with teachers, you would have tutors and those kind of things. There weren't really any specific things available to me other than medication at the time. And that was a hit or miss sort of endeavor. Yeah. So one thing that was really interesting is that some teachers embraced that understanding, that information, while other teachers didn't. For example, I had one teacher in a class that I was struggling in, and during parent-teacher conferences, as he was talking to my father brought up the fact that I had learning disabilities, and the teacher said, like, that's a him problem, that's not a me problem. And wow. This is coming from one teacher to another teacher, right? So a lot of times people focus on learning disabilities, but people often don't really even acknowledge that there are teaching disabilities as well. There are people who are better teachers and people who are not as good. And as with every other profession, there is a spectrum. But when it comes to teachers, that's a very important thing to acknowledge, right? Because maybe somebody's not bad at something. It's just that the information isn't being delivered in a way that is helpful. And sometimes that was the case. And sometimes I just had I was challenged by information. I had very diligent teachers who helped me get a lot better at things just by helping me surface my own abilities when they could. But I feel in large part the way I was able to make progress was figuring out my own challenges.
It's interesting. I suffer from mild dyslexia and had real problems at school with reading sentences and writing and spelling in particular. And it's not something that was ever addressed. It was just like, oh yeah, you've got a problem. You're not very bright. Mm-hmm. But that was Scotland in the 1970s. Different story. I've heard you say in regard to your ADD that you could focus, but you just had too many things to focus on at the same time. Can you explain a bit more about the context of that and the experience?
Well, certainly. It's a big misconception is that people with ADD can't focus, and that wasn't my experience. It was nearly impossible for me to focus on something that I wasn't interested in, which I think is a fairly common affliction, but the difference being, like, I could actually be trying my best. I'd be like staring at a teacher and the words coming out of their mouth would just evaporate. Like, it just wouldn't stick. Because my attention was constantly being drawn to something else. Like, I don't know, there's like birds in the trees that I haven't seen before, somebody's new shoes, or like, you know, something that I'd been reading somewhere else. I'd always be thinking about something and I would cycle through those things very quickly. But if I liked doing something, I could focus on it for hours on end, which was something that was constantly confusing to teachers, especially once in a while I would be in a class where I wasn't doing well, and then there would be a project, and all of a sudden it was like I was a transformed student because this one project happened to align with the things that really engaged my mind. So it was really hard to kind of pinpoint a way forward, because I was kind of at the mercy of the assignments that I would get.
So when did you start your own experimentation in terms of looking at tools, techniques to help you address what you now understood to be a disability or an ability to learn in the traditional way?
I would say it happened probably early in middle school when I was having challenges specifically in math and some history courses as well, because again, it was like a lot of memorization. And I realized that people's notes just look different than mine. Right. Like, I would have like two or three notes on a page compared to somebody else who would just continuously be turning out pages. And I realized it's just because I wasn't listening to a lot of it. And the first technique that helped a lot was I started drawing because I always liked drawing. I was always doodling in my notebooks. And at first I did it because I was spacing out, admittedly. But what was interesting is when I more regularly doodled during a lecture or a class, I would start hearing things in a different way. So drawing actually occupied the part of my mind that needed to be distracted constantly. And once I realized that, I would receive the information. I would actually be able to pick up on it. And then I could take notes. I'd stop drawing and write things down. I'd stop drawing and write things down. Of course, teachers don't really like seeing kids doodling in class because they think that they're not paying attention. So then what I'd have to start doing is pretending that I was taking notes when they looked at me. And when they turned around, I'd start drawing again.
That in itself must have taken focus in a funny sort of way.
Well, it was just strange. It was kind of like this shame-driven productivity hack, right? Where I didn't want them to know what I needed to do in order to actually stay on the same level as my other classmates, which I thought was, you know, looking back on it, that's kind of sad. But it wasn't until one teacher realized what was happening and they pulled me aside and they said, you know, it's really interesting with you. At first, I was really upset by your drawing, but now I realize that every time you're drawing, you're actually hearing me. And every time you're looking at me, you're not. So good for you for figuring that out. And when you're young, you generally speaking, look towards the tall folks for answers, right? Uh-huh. The teachers, your parents, your siblings. It never really occurs to you that you're allowed to solve your own challenges, that you can even do that. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, that kind of flipped the switch. I'm like, well, if I figured out something that works for me, like what else can I figure out? And that's kind of what began this journey. And that was really interesting to me. How can I get better? Like I knew that I wasn't good. Like the failure was already the norm for me. So my relationship to failure is kind of different in some regards. For me, it was never about being perfect. That wasn't an option. But better all of a sudden became an option and better started becoming really motivating.
Just in much of interest, of your parents both being teachers, how did they help you embrace that? Because there could have been a sort of a negative impact of that failure at the time, which just became self-reinforcing. But obviously it didn't, as you say. You recontextualized failure and it was became about becoming better. Did your parents affect that in any way, or was that just something that came from inside you?
My parents had a large influence on that. Specifically, they never encouraged me to be getting A's. That was never interesting to them. The way that they motivated me was asking me to do my best. And that was a really mature quest of a child, like to do my best, because the responsibility was on me. And I like that, right? If they say get an A, that's an impossibility. Like, I don't know what to do with that because it's not like I'm not trying. I'm just not able to do this right now. But if I try my best, then I'm holding myself accountable at all times. And that's something that they really baked into me. It's like, we don't care what your grades are. We care how much effort you put into getting those grades. And it focuses on the process and not the outcome. And that's something that's influenced me my entire life. Like the process is something that I can control. The outcome is something I can't control. At a young age, I didn't realize how profound that was. But as I've gotten older, realizing that and really focusing on that has allowed me to continuously be productive even when I'm striving towards things that seem very unattainable.
And the reality of focusing on the process and not the outcome in itself probably enhances the outcome in the long term anyway.
Absolutely. By focusing on the process, you're focusing on what you can control. And understanding what you can control and what you can't is critical. I think we spend an incredible amount of our time and energy worrying about things that we can't control. And we have massive anxiety and burn ourselves out unnecessarily. And if we can focus on the things that we can control, we're investing time and energy into something we can actually impact. And the more impact we can have, the more likely something is to succeed.
As you started to experiment with these different techniques and building on what the insight from the German teacher than what she had at middle school. By the time you sort of left school at 18 and came to the US, where had you got to with your, let's say, was it journaling at that point, or was this just some an approach you developed to retain information and to learn and develop?
By the time I left high school, I had started creating templates, I would say, but those templates lived all over the place. I hadn't gotten to the place yet where I funneled everything into one book At that time, I was actually still scrapbooking as well, which was, I was really into photography in middle school and high school. So I guess I still am. And back then, you actually had physical photos. So one thing that I really liked was, and something that helped my memory tremendously, was actually coming back to my pictures and starting to write these notes. But I realized the more that I wrote, the less I would do it. So I started developing, I guess, the primordial version of rapid logging, where I would just add individual sentences to kind of contextualize the image. It wasn't until college where I started figuring out ways to actually bring my notebooks together and consolidate it. I didn't have scrapbooks anymore, but I really missed the value of the act of reflection that they brought into my life. Scrapbooking is reflection, right? You're coming back to your memories and everything. And I found that I could replicate that in this different way of journaling, which I refer to as rapid logging, essentially writing down your thoughts as short form sentences. So I would figure out alternatives for the things that I missed. And then in terms of my actual education, my classes, I would continue to develop different kinds of templates in order to have the best format for the content that I was receiving. You know, like my poetry class and my philosophy class did not have the same notes, not the same structure. And as I studied graphic design in college as well. And as I started learning about design systems and different ways of creating narratives through layout and everything, I would take those and adopt them into my own notebook, which was funny because my graphic design program was digital, and yet it all came back into my notebook.
But it's interesting as you talk about the process and the methodology that you, maybe through happenstance and just through trial and error, that you were adopting as you grew older. Mm-hmm. It almost is a design thinking methodology in mm-hmm. practice, even before you had trained as a designer. Do you think that influenced your decision to move into design, albeit you've got parents that were teachers in art and I think you're in writing as well? Mm-hmm. But the fact that you were predisposed to drawing, you're probably more artistically inclined and had started to develop a design methodology yourself. What's your sense of how that directed your own personal path towards the career that you started?
There are a couple different threads there. I would say it wasn't until I started really working on product design and software design that I felt at home. Mm-hmm. It was the first place I'd ever been where failure is accepted. In the iterative process, mm-hmm. essentially what you're looking for is just to cycle through different solutions as fast as possible until you find things that worked, and then you iterate on that, and then you iterate on that. And that was a language I was very familiar with. It was interesting that it had become so established in a field that was so far removed from that child that I was at some point, because for me, failure was very common. So at some point I was like, okay, chances are I'm going to fail, but what can I do better? So when I finally started designing software, that just seemed like a natural fit for me. And I was drawn to design in the first place because I really like narratives and I really like designing things. Like formulating space is something that I've always been interested in. Even as a kid, I'd like redesign my room constantly, or again with the scrapbooks, like figuring out different ways to put things together. So figuring out ways to combine both narrative and visuals has been something that's been constant throughout my life.
There's a quote in the Bullet Journal I read, I think it's Alan Saunders, one of the ones you use, which is, life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. Mm-hmm. I wanted to weave in there a question around serendipity. I mean, what sort of chance encounters, happy accidents, or serendipitous sort of life moments or events occurred that really sort of defined or changed the direction of your journey when you were maybe busy doing something else?
It's a big question. Yes. So when I first moved to New York, I lived in a basement apartment that I shared with roommates. And after,
which part of town?
Sorry?
Which part of town?
I would say it's south slope.
Oh, right. Okay.
I don't even think it was considered part of Park Slope at the time, but that's what it said in the Craigslist ad. That was a very charitable representation of the neighborhood. It was just very far away. It wasn't scary or bad. It was just not occupied. Like you wouldn't see people
some
there.
Less than salubrious parts of that area from having run through it a few times.
I mean, at the time it was fine. It just was empty. It was a ghost town. That's what I could afford. And it snowed. It was one of those crazy 100-year storms or something. It snowed so intensely that we couldn't even open the door to get out. And then there was like a weird or an unexpected heat surge or something. So all the snow melted overnight, and I woke up the next day and I saw that my floor was moving. And it was like, I actually was able to focus my eyes. I realized that the floor wasn't moving, it was underwater, and floating by my bed was my portfolio.
Oh,
right. Everything that I designed in college. Yeah, pretty much my life's work and my computer was.
So all your graphic design portfolio that you'd spent in college.
Yes, basically my full investment in college was completely waterlogged. Because at the time you didn't really, there wasn't a digital way to present your stuff. Like, I remember one of the last classes, because I was in the first year.
Yeah, of course, Behance didn't exist at that point, did it?
Behance didn't exist, but there weren't really personal websites yet, you know, unless you were quote-unquote a hacker, which wasn't a good representation either, but unless you were super computer savvy, that didn't exist. I remember one of the last classes I took in college was actually, I think it was like Director or something, where you could create interactive digital piece. I mean, it was... Let's say we're better off now. But so I lost all my work, and then I basically needed to find, I'd been looking for jobs anyway, and I'd been doing that relatively unsuccessfully. Now I'd been looking for work for a long time, and I'd been looking for work with what I believed to be this really killer body of work, which all of a sudden went up and, well, I guess went down and drowned. And so I was even less desirable. Even with my best work, I wasn't having any luck, because New York has a very competitive talent pool. There were a lot of very, very good people competing for the same jobs, and now I couldn't even compete for those. So I took whatever work I could, and that job was miserable.
Design job.
That would be a very charitable way of describing it. Mostly, it was a production job, so mostly what I did was design order forms. Order forms with tens of thousands of entries. I'd spend months working on these things, and they'd always be wrong because there was no real technical infrastructure to keep things updated. So I'd have to cobble these things together from various different sources, and it never worked out. I found out the people who had this job before me had all run screaming, and I could see why.
It's quite incredible that someone who suffered but had overcome to a degree their ADD ended up doing something so specific and detail orientated.
Yeah, I mean, when you have that much data, the details kind of go out the window at that point, because all you're doing is just basically throwing all these things into a bucket. I couldn't really affect it, but obviously people wouldn't. Anyway, long story short, it was a very dysfunctional process. It was more of like, somebody needs to be the person to do it, and it's always going to be wrong, and people don't want it to be them. So it was a kind of scapegoat.
Do you think you
position.
Learned anything from that experience? Did it benefit you in any small way?
Well, that job was problematic for a lot of reasons. I also had a really abusive boss in that job. So it was hell on multiple different levels. And if anything, at the lowest points in my career after that, I could always look back and find something to be grateful for, that I wasn't doing that. I'd had bad jobs before that I'd enjoyed, but this was something else, because it got so bad, especially because my boss would terrorize me in some ways, that I was actually scared to go to work. And that was strange. Mm-hmm. You know, you wake up and you're scared. You go to bed and you're scared to wake up.
And you're forced to, because you need the paycheck.
Yeah, I had no option. I had no option. Not that the paycheck was helping that much, but it was better than not. That was it. And it forced me into a corner. So it taught me a couple of things. One is to be grateful for what I have. And that continues to be the case no matter how bad things get. And the second thing is that I need to take responsibility for what happens next. Nothing's going to fall into my lap. And it got so bad that I basically took whatever money I could eke out of my paycheck and put myself back in school. And I started studying web design, because I'd spent a lot of time. Around that time, people started creating personal sites, especially like really out there multimedia artists and smaller, really cool companies. And
this must have been, what, about 2002?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, the web was very nascent, especially for not big companies. And I really liked what I saw. It was kind of like the Wild West. People were creating these really crazy things, and they were interactive, and they used different kinds of media, even video. I mean, you know, super pixelated and tiny videos, but I really enjoyed that, and I wanted to learn more about it.
There must be an element of frustration as well, knowing that a couple of years before, you could have uploaded all your
your portfolio, but
no well, point looking back.
Yeah, right. I mean, as you said, also the idea of being able to show my work and having it in, well, I mean, the cloud wasn't really a word back then, but not having it at the, not having it be a victim to a negligent landlord was definitely something that was interesting to me. Plus people, small businesses started to bring up websites, and a couple of my friends asked me if that's something I could do, because I was like the Photoshop guy at the time. And I was like, no, not yet. And then I went to school, and like, literally, I remember maybe the third class or something, we learned how to like rotate a GIF or create a rotating GIF. We created like a pizza website or something. And I just remember the teacher wasn't particularly good, but I just loved the subject matter. I loved coding, and I loved taking the work that I'd created and putting it online, and there weren't any real rules yet. And it was just really engaging. And I spent a lot of time, all my free time, really getting better at this stuff. And eventually I started getting gigs. I would make a website for a band, and then like the band's one of the people in the band worked for a restaurant, so I got my first restaurant gig, and then another restaurant
and this,
gig.
And this is just for anyone that's sort of listening that is living in the world of WordPress development or sort of self-built sites like Squarespace and Wix. This is hand-coded web development. Mm-hmm. This is before the days of any sort of page builders or anything like this. And you're having to get into the sort of the HTML.
But, you know, it's like learning on the job. I had no idea what I was doing, but I was learning very quickly, and every project got much better. And I realized that this was really something that I loved. It engaged every part of me. I got to design things. I got to like create narratives, and coding was really interesting. Not that I'm a good coder, but you know, it was about finding something that I would look forward to working on, no matter who the client was. And that was a huge departure from the experience that I was currently having. Mm-hmm. So I tried to figure out a way to do that full time, and eventually I was able to.
Well, I've read, there's a, I can't remember who said it, but it's not the circumstances that define you. It's your response to them. And it sounds like your reaction to the circumstances you found yourself in was a real reflection of a pretty stoic approach to life and just getting on, knuckling down and dealing with the hardship. Let's use that as a way to sort of segue into the bullet journal. Mm-hmm. Because obviously you sort of moved on at that point and made a sort of a pretty significant sort of change of direction in your life by starting in web design. Can you talk us through the sort of the journey from there to really developing the bullet journal?
I would say by that time, the bullet journal had started taking on a familiar look at that point. It's not what I ended up releasing years and years later, but at that point, I had been using my notebook specifically for a lot of professional work, and especially with web stuff, it lent itself well to the templates that I ended up developing. But I would say, so transitioning over from this production job, I was doing these small web projects, and that didn't necessarily cover all the bills. So I'd have to also cater waiter for a while, and eventually I started getting freelance work, or I would say permalance work, where I'd work for a company for 3 or 4 months. And as I started working with companies that actually had teams that worked specifically on digital, specifically online, I started also being exposed to a lot more design methodologies and everything. And over the years, I was introduced to Agile and all these things. And my life became more and more and more digital. And the things I would learn, I'd bring back to analog. And I was wondering why I was doing this. As much as I love the digital space, I found that when I disconnected and went offline and actually engaged with my notebook, I could think much more clearly. And that was important, because as with somebody with ADD, I can like think nonstop. Like the thoughts are racing constantly, and I can spend a lot of time getting very little done. And I found that it was due to the unlimited nature of technology. Like you can code indefinitely, you can surf, you can research indefinitely.
Well, being stuck in a browser with ADD must be potentially a living hell.
Yeah, I mean, till this day, I'll have like 40 tabs on my browser,
my God, yeah. I have that as well.
You know, it's
if
it's,
not more.
Yeah, people often think that I'm some hyper organized human being, and what I try to remind them of is that if I was, the bullet journal wouldn't exist. Mm-hmm. Right, it solves my challenges, and as I got more and more into digital space, I saw that I needed my notebook. and it helped me think better. So I spent that time developing even further the different methodologies that I had been cultivating over, you know, at that point, decades. And it kept on becoming more and more helpful and more lean and more targeted. And especially I realized that it helped me become a lot more intentional. As soon as I would go offline, I would actually take the time to critically think about something undistracted by yet another shiny thing. And it had a huge impact on my own productivity and my own ability to focus. And until this day, if I don't use my notebook, the edges start to fray very quickly. Mm-hmm. So when I realized that my notebook was becoming such an essential and impactful tool, I spent a lot more time trying to clarify the way that I used it, and I made it much more systematic and started figuring out ways that the different systems would play with each other. Essentially, what I was doing was designing an analog app. It was, mm-hmm. it was an application based on all these. At first, it was just a loose toolkit, essentially, with all these different things that I had tried. But over time, I really started to enjoy weaving them together. I enjoyed the process, but I also enjoyed the effect that they were having. But I never imagined sharing it with anyone else.
Because it sounds like a very iterative process, mm-hmm. that you went through, and to apply, use the sort of the language of the sort of the industry and the design, mm-hmm. industry, it almost was real-time test-driven development.
That's exactly correct.
And do you just working out what worked for you, what didn't work, removing it, improving it, releasing a next version.
Mm-hmm.
At what point do you get to where you started to realize you built something or you designed something that had a purpose beyond just your ability to live a more intentional life?
I never did, actually. Mm. That was a light bulb moment that somebody else brought on. So at one of these jobs that I was working at, I actually got the job through a friend who was working there, and she was in the middle of planning her wedding. And I walked by her desk one day, and her desk was just a complete mess with these, all the different things she had to keep track of, and like three notebooks, post-it notes, all of it. And for some reason, I volunteered to show her how I organized myself, because I knew that desk was like a representation of my own mind in some ways. Mm-hmm. And to my horror, she took me up on the offer. It never occurred to me to share it with anybody else before, but I wanted to give back somehow for the kindness that she had extended towards me. And so I showed her how I organized myself. But at the time, I had no vocabulary or language for it. This is just the way that I thought. And that became painfully clear to me as I tried to explain it to somebody else. Like, this is how my brain works. This is how I think. Or this is the tool I used to help me think more clearly, better said. And when I was done with it, she was just like staring at me with her mouth hanging open. And I was like, oh no, she thinks I'm crazy. And the first thing that she said to me was, you have to share this with people. And that was the first time it occurred to me that I had something here.
What year was that?
Maybe 2004. Four or five.
Okay. And this was a design agency you were working in at the time?
It was actually a fashion company, and I was working for their e-com team.
Huh.
I was working at the time. Apparently they'd lost all their website assets from a redesign, so I had to recreate them by eye.
Oh.
There was a lot of pixel peeping. And I mean, the people were great, and it was my first opportunity at a really big company to get a leg in. And that was the beginning of what became a really successful career in web and product design.
So when she said you had to share it with the world, what was your reaction to hearing something like that that probably came out of left field for you?
Well, I had two simultaneous reactions. One, she's just being nice, mm-hmm. right? And secondly, the second one was more interesting. She clearly thought it was going to be helpful to her. And what's more interesting is actually seeing her in the next couple of weeks using some of the stuff and coming to me and asking for clarification about what about this problem or this scenario. And then I realized that my first reaction hadn't been true. She actually found value in it. And seeing her use it was what changed my mind.
Mm-hmm.
because when a friend introduces you to something, I'd be like, that's terrible, right? And she was a very kind person, but the fact that she used it, that's what changed my mind. And then other people saw that what she was doing, and she told them that I was the guy who had shown her, so they would ask me at that job. And that pattern started to repeat over and over again. But it wasn't until years later, where I was between two different projects, where I had, I would say, 2 weeks to kind of kill. And I wanted to create a project. I wanted to create something that would give back to the same community that had helped me learn so much. Because remember, back in the Wild West days, essentially, a lot of people were just sharing what they learned for free. It's like, I don't know what I'm doing, but this is what I learned. And these were some of the best and brightest in all these different fields. And I always just felt so grateful for that. You know, they're not asking for money. They're not teaching classes. They're like, here's this incredible amount of knowledge for free. And I wanted to create something like that. But the problem was I didn't know what I could share. I'm not the best designer in the world, certainly not a coder that could add any value, a programmer that could add any value to the existing community, which had far surpassed me at that point. Like, what do I do that is unique to me that I think could add value? Mm-hmm. And then it occurred to me, it's like, I use my notebook in a very particular way, in an uncommon way, something I haven't seen before. And what also dawned on me is that even though I worked with digital natives, and at that time at agencies, many people always had a paper notebook with them. So at first, the idea of sharing my system with my own community was simply that. It's like, they use notebooks, I use notebooks in this way. Maybe I know that at least one person finds this really helpful. Mm-hmm. Surely there's got to be a couple others. And that was the goal. I'm going to show people the very basics. I peeled everything out of it except for the things that had consistently been valuable to me, proven themselves over time, and came up with a new language, came up with a way to teach it using the skills I had acquired over time, and built a website, an interactive website that taught people how to bullet journal. That's what I ended up calling it. And that was it. That was the whole goal behind the bullet journals, to help people avoid or mitigate the same heartache that I had to go through when I was younger.
Okay. Well, can you give us an overview of the what and the how of the bullet journal.
So the bullet journal is a method, and the method consists of two main parts. You have the system, which is what people are more familiar with, and that's what you see on Instagram and Pinterest, and then you have the practice, which lies below the system, essentially. The system you can think of as a Lego set. It's modular. And it's made of many different pieces, and each one of those pieces serves a very specific purpose. And that purpose is usually to collect similar kinds of information. So, for example, you could have a shopping list or a fertility tracker or a project.
And the thing or a podcast planner.
Or a podcast planner, right? Well, that's a big part of it. Because it's modular and because it's a Lego set, people can design their own pieces and plug it into the framework. So what I teach are essentially the foundations. I give people the core pieces that they need to build their own custom-tailored productivity system, if you want. And that's why no two bullet journals look the same, because everybody uses it based on their own needs.
It's a shame. I wish mine looked like yours, but that's something to do with my handwriting and maybe the way my brain works.
I think it's really important to realize. I get that a lot, right? Which is funny, because my bullet journal is not nearly as beautiful as half the examples you see online. And I always like to stress that what it looks like doesn't matter, right? And it's about how effective it is. Yeah. And that's really at the core of the practice, is figuring out, learning about yourself and designing tools that help you get closer to the things that you want, figuring out what you want to spend more time doing, and figure out how you can spend less time doing the things that don't add value to your life. And we do that through mostly reflection and introspection.
Because you're talking about the how, and I've read the book. I've started the journaling. I'm using the index to capture the monthly log, the future log, the daily logs, and like say my podcast planners and fertility trackers maybe at some point. But for me, there's a bigger thing, the why of it. When you start to talk about that, it's really interesting. The Nietzsche quote, "When you know your why, you can endure any how." For me, this is at the heart of what you're actually doing, helping people explore and arrive at their own personal whys. Mm-hmm. Because you talk about the ultimate end benefit of this is living a more intentional life. Do you think that's a fair assessment in terms of how your you intended this to help people align their beliefs and their actions to drive a more intentional life?
Yes. So the way you can look at it is this. We live in a time now where we nearly like worship productivity. But in my own experience, I have worked incredibly productive for years towards something that ended up not mattering at all to me, because the goals I had set or the goals that I was working towards were never my own. Mm-hmm. They were things that I had adopted or just kind of accepted from my community or my culture. I had never stopped to think about what is it that I actually want. And that happened with my first startup. I spent 2 years working on this product, and I did this on top of a really demanding full-time job. I sacrificed a lot to do that, to be able to launch this product. And I loved working on it because it was more of what I liked to do, and the person I was working with was fantastic, a really gifted programmer. Every night, all weekends, for 2 years, we worked towards this thing. And then like a day after launch, I walked into the office and it just didn't matter at all. And that was a horrifying thing to realize, because I got everything that I had met my goal and it was empty. Success felt like a failure. And to me, that was a huge wake up call. I'm like, why is it? And the answer was simple. It's like, I didn't know what I wanted. I didn't know what was valuable to me, because I was just so busy being productive. And that's why the bullet journal is a two-part thing. So how do you figure out what you want? And I think part of the answer there is in becoming more mindful. And for me, mindfulness is about becoming present and starting to really understand yourself better, not always looking forward, but actually being here right now and seeing what comes up. And journaling can be very helpful in that context, because A, you're taking time to think, to actually declutter your mind. And the way that the methodology works is that you re-engage with the content that you're creating. As you're writing things down, you're creating a record of your experience. And through bullet journaling, you start to study that experience and you can start identifying patterns. What's working? What isn't? What do I want more of? What do I want less of? What should the focus be for me right now? And when you become more mindful, you have a lot of insights. But this is the problem with mindfulness, right? You've probably read books or seen movies or seen art that have been incredibly inspirational. They gave you an idea or a concept that if you brought it into your life would change things. You could become more empowered or more focused or happier or something like that. But where is that 4 months later? What role does it play in your life? And I found that in my own journey, I guess, when I got really into mindfulness, I'd be doing a lot of different kinds of meditations and I have all these insights. And the thing is that insights are thoughts and they evaporate. So what I started doing is taking these insights and actually figuring out a way to plug them into the things that I was working on. How does this insight affect my life right now? And that's really what the bullet journal method is all about, is taking the insights, the things that we learn, and putting them into action. And as you said, thereby aligning your actions with your beliefs to live a more intentional life. But we can get back to the Nietzsche quote if you want.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, the intentional life, I mean, it's going back to what you said earlier. It's a lot of really focusing on taking control of what you can, focus on what you can control and ignoring what you can't is really at the heart of this. When you were talking about earlier, about having time away from a browser and just looking at the paper and reflecting, it made me think about Darwin's thinking path. And, you know, I've talked about this before, about the ability to, where do new ideas come from and where do you sort of escape, get out of your mind and explore and become creative. And in a sense, the way you're describing that time you spend reflecting with your journal almost is your version of Darwin's thinking path. And I find that it's an interesting thing that all of us are so caught up. And as there was another quote you used in the book about, you say, yeah, we're in the midst of our technology spiral, always in a frenetic cycle of reactivity, stimulus, reaction that holds our attention hostage, unable to slow down or spot opportunities for love, growth, and purpose. And I suppose that, in a sense, the journal is an antidote to that cycle.
It has been that for me, certainly. Mm-hmm. Again, I think we can get so caught up moving forward that we don't see what is here right now. And that's really important, because you can't control the future. and you can't change the past, so all you're left with is the right now, the present. And, you know, without this being, without it sounding very woo-woo, it's like the more you actually pay attention to what's happening right now, the more you can actually influence the future for the better. And I found that to be true over and over and over again. And I realized that the more I'm paying attention to the future, the worse that I'm getting at it, right? Or the worse it's unfolding. And that's because I'm not paying attention to what I could be doing and what I could be controlling right now. And it's also helped me become more content, right? Because I think that a lot of our lives are a reflection of the stories that we tell ourselves. And a lot of those stories are hope, right? If only this, if only that, if only that, then I'll be happy. Yeah. And I feel like that is the most dangerous story we can tell ourselves, because I don't think that happiness should be a goal, which we can get into as well. No, I think that that's something that we're sold and that we've bought into too much. I had myself until one day I realized it wasn't serving me.
And having worked in advertising, you're only one step away, one more purchase away from happiness.
Exactly.
It's a great promise.
Well, marketing isn't about like, thank you for buying our phone. It's always about thank you for the phone and here's, you know, an upgrade or next year's a better phone. It's always about better. It's not about good enough. And the thing is, the promise of better is a real distraction, and it's a dangerous one because it doesn't teach us how to focus on the now. And by focusing on the now, we get better at telling ourselves stories about what is happening currently. Like, maybe things are pretty good right now. It's not about positive thinking. It's about figuring out what you're grateful for in your life. And that's really important, because when you figure out what you're grateful for, you can spend more time with those things, right? You can start realizing that if you can be more content currently, then you're going to be significantly happier than waiting for something to make you happy, because that thing will probably never come, or it won't come the way that you want it to. But if you can start training yourself to actually let in things that make you grateful and that add value to your life, and train yourself to find those things. And this is really the critical point, is it doesn't come naturally. It's like, if you're not necessarily a grateful person, having a gratitude practice isn't going to flip that switch. Yeah. It's like any other skill. You look for things in the world that aren't bad. That's the first part, right? These are things that aren't bad. And maybe you find something that's good, and then you see more of the things that are good. And over time, it starts to change your story. It starts to change your narrative. I think one of my favorite lines is, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. Uh-huh. And I think a lot of the stories that we tell ourselves make us suffer indefinitely. And I think part of changing that story is figuring out ways not to suffer. And one of the ways not to suffer is actually to find the things that aren't bad in your life.
And taking control of it by journaling is the first step towards avoiding that.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I think that by journaling, you start training yourself to become more perceptive.
Mm-hmm. And reflective.
Exactly.
As you say, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Both of those things, I think, go hand in hand.
I'm conscious of time, because I know you have to run soon. And I've got to get into some quickfire questions. I mean, there's a whole bunch of other stuff I'd love to talk about, goal setting and your agile approach. Minimalism and intentionality I wanted to touch on as well, but I don't think maybe I have to do a follow-up at some point and a deeper dive into it. Let's see. We'll do the quickfire questions, see if there's any time left. What principles do you stand by?
I think Seth Godin put it in a really lovely way, which is, you can be the creator of energy or the destroyer of it. And I think that ripples into so many different things. I try to be the creator of energy in everything that I do. I think it's easy to be negative. I think it's lazy. And it's obvious, right? Everything ends. Mm-hmm. But it's much harder to appreciate the things that exist for as long as they do, and appreciate people's effort and hope. Yeah, I would say that would be the principle that I stand by. It's not necessarily a principle, but a guiding guiding
but
philosophy.
I suppose your work, your output is also a testament to that as well. So,
thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that.
What hard choices have you had to make that might have been tough at the time, but turned out to be have been the right decision in the end?
I would say the most recent one is that I loved my job. I loved my career as a product designer, and I hope to reengage with that someday. I worked for a company that believed in me and supported me. I had everything that you could possibly want, more or less, and I walked away from it to focus on Bullet Journal full time, to be able to focus on creating this book and serving my community. That was a very hard choice to make. I walked away from certainty to uncertainty.
Well, I suppose there's no certainty of where it's going to go, but we'll maybe come back and touch
certainly
on that.
Certainly not.
Well, the one certainty there is that things always change. So, well, let's ask, I think this next question we've maybe already answered. Where do you go or what do you do to discover new ideas or when you need space to think? This probably isn't the question for you because that presumably is the bullet journal.
Well, I mean, I think through journaling, certainly, but I was just talking to a friend of mine about this. I get new ideas everywhere. There's nothing I can do that will give me more ideas other than exposing myself to new things. That's mm-hmm. it. And that's really why I like traveling and why I try out so many different things, because that's when my brain is uncomfortable. And that's usually when it starts to figure out, I guess it approaches life from different directions, you know, when life isn't comfortable. So I would say if I ever feel stuck or in a rut, I try new things. That I would say that's the most consistent way, but it happens everywhere. The problem was that I wasn't writing things down, you know, which was another reason why journaling has become very key for me.
Okay. Who are your influencers and inspirations? I mean, you obviously inspire through your work and your journal. Many people, as you can see, a testament to that in Instagram and Pinterest. But you must have someone you look to as your great influencer.
That changes consistently depending on what I'm interested in. I would say that a lot of meditation teachers have definitely had a profound influence on me. Tara Brach's work was one of the first that really shook things up for me. I mean, I guess it just depends on the field. Like, you know, I try to surround myself and my time with people who know so much more than I ever will. So I spend a lot of time learning. I would say Tara Brach was huge. And a lot of books too, you know.
Well, I'm going to ask you about books.
Sure.
But just a matter of interest, what is your current go-to meditation app at the moment?
Sam Harris's.
Oh, yeah. Waking Up. Yeah. I'm doing that as well. It's good. He's a fantastic guy.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do to keep up with technology, both personally and for your business?
You know, as much as I love the analog, like I definitely am an early adopter. My relationship with technology has changed, though. Whereas before, I just like buy into anything indiscriminately. Right? It's like, oh, that looks great. Let's, you know, hop on board. Now I keep a list of the problems that I have in my business or my company. Like, okay, this is an inefficiency. This is an inefficiency. And then I try to back into technology to solve those inefficiencies. Like a lot of times at first I would just, technology for me was solving all these problems I didn't know that I had, you know, and that ended up being a waste of time. So I try to find technology that really addresses problems for me. That's my strategy with adopting technology, and I love it. You know, I love technology, and I don't think, you know, people always ask me, is like analog or digital? And I don't think it's analog versus digital. I think it's analog and digital. They're all just tools, and tools are only as effective as they help you to move forward. But technology has so many different tools.
Okay, that's a good answer. The impossible question. What would your advice be to someone maybe 20 years old that may have a dream, a grand ambition, a big goal, but that's being told by people around them, teachers, parents, friends, that's impossible?
I guess the first thing I would ask them is, like, why do you want to do it exactly? You know, because when I talk to a lot of people who have these grand ambitions. It's like, I want to become a millionaire, or I want to become, you know, famous, or an actor or a singer, or, you know, those are all fine ambitions.
Not particularly purposeful.
You know, I'm not here to judge, but in my own experience, a lot of those aren't their goals. It's just an idea. Well, I mean, it is their goal, but it's not, it's empty. Mm-hmm. It's something they see and they're like, that looks cool. Right. But that looks cool is not.
Influenced by Instagram.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're constantly inundated with mm-hmm. the things that we should want. And that usually distracts us from the things that would actually add value to your life. And the example I give is, you know, I want to have $1 million. It's like, why? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, then I'll be rich or whatever. It's like, no, why exactly will that add value to your life? And once you start answering that question, you start also finding smaller ways forward. Let's say you want to become rich for whatever reason. Once you define that reason, like let's say, okay, I want to buy a house for my parents to retire in. I want to pay off my student loans. I want to make sure that my kids don't have student loans. I estimate that's going to cost X amount of dollars. Like all of a sudden, that ambition has a real purpose, has a real meaning based on your lived experience. So for somebody who's young and hungry and everything, I feel like figuring out what their motivation is truly, and then figuring out what actions they can take right now to move towards those things. Because I feel like a lot of people, like myself, have these big ambitions that don't mean anything. They don't mean nothing. And it's really important for people to realize that it's their responsibility to clearly define what they want on their own terms. Mm-hmm. Because if they don't, then they're working towards other people's goals.
Okay. Well, that's a good answer. Final two questions. What book would you like us to offer our listeners that come up with the best questions, best comments in the comment section? Bullet Journal would be the obvious one, which I'm sure we'll offer, but there must be one other book as well that you would like people to read.
I think Essentialism is a great one.
Yeah.
I mean, we never delved into minimalism, but you know, his work is great. I think Tara Brach's book, Radical Acceptance, is a good one.
Yeah.
If you're interested in gratitude and figuring out how to become more present.
Okay. For anyone that wants to dive into the bullet journal method and practice, where should they go to find out about it?
You can go to bulletjournal.com. There's free tutorials and articles that spell things out in detail. If you're interested in seeing what it looks like, you can just check out the hashtag bullet journal on Instagram or Pinterest.
Okay, we'll do that. Well, thank you very much. Have you got time for me just to jump back into a couple of questions, or do you have to run?
I got another, I'd say, 10 minutes.
Okay, well, I'm trying to do five then.
I just wanted to also...
No, that's fine.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, no, I really appreciate it. I wanted to ask about BJ Fogg and his tiny habits. He runs a behavioral science unit at Stanford, and he talks about the importance of tiny habits and affecting sort of behavioral change in your life. And he said there's only three ways you can do it: have an epiphany, change your environment or what's around you, or take baby steps, small actionable projects. It struck me when I was reading about your process, you also talk about in the book of reflect, ideate, and dedicate, that for me that was all about the process of taking, it almost felt like tiny habits and changing behavior. And I just wondered what underpinned that whole process, how you came up with that idea of reflect, ideate, and dedicate.
It's not something that just dawned on me. It's something that I experienced over time. It's something that worked itself out. I feel like the only way to make progress is through developing a work ethic, something consistent, which is only part of it. Because if you're consistently doing the same thing and failing constantly, that's just terrible for your motivation, not to mention for your self-worth. So how do you make consistent progress and keep yourself motivated? And in my own experience, I found out that just by reducing the amount of pressure on myself and figuring out what the smallest possible step is that I could take, I'd be much more likely to do it. And at first I would set the bar so low that I was almost offending myself. It's like, this is ridiculous. How is this going to help? It's like, well, it's going to help because you're going to do it 40 times. And then all of a sudden you've actually made progress on this tiny thing, as opposed to trying something really hard, failing and just walking away from it, which means it's dead in the water. And I found that once I started making things easier on myself in terms of how much I had to do or how much I had to get accomplished or how big the next step would be, I was taking a lot more steps and I was actually making progress consistently and I would keep my motivation up and, you know, so much positive progress would happen with such little effort.
Which is also interesting, touching on when you mentioned happiness earlier. I mean, I think it's proven in terms of neuroscience that by taking actions, by achieving small things, even albeit they might not be massive steps forward, it's affecting having a dopamine impact mm-hmm. in your brain, which obviously is then driving towards a greater sense of self-satisfaction, and which the outcome quite possibly might be happiness.
Momentarily, sure, but I think in my own life, I don't try to strive for happiness. I just strive for something that's meaningful. Mm-hmm. So I try to align the things that I'm working on with something that I believe adds value to my life or that I believe in, period. So just the mere act of being able to work on it is something that I'm already grateful for, but also excited about. And excitement to me is something I think we can generate significantly more consistently than happiness. You know, you're like, ooh, I can't wait to work on this. It's going to be hard and I'm going to have bad days, but at least I know why I'm doing it and I can't wait to come back to solve this problem over and over and over again. But I think what is really critical is to make sure that you are able to make progress, because if you don't, you can lose your motivation, you can lose your excitement, you can lose your purpose. Mm-hmm.
And your intentionality.
Right.
I want to ask you about goal setting. Mm-hmm. I've spent a lot. I was an athlete when I was younger, and a lot of my time went into very precise sort of goal setting, and obviously relating beliefs, desires, and action into that. But I want to get your perspective on a couple of things: the alchemy of how endurance, persistence, passion, curiosity all intersect in that. Because you talk about in the book about the importance of endurance and persistence and perseverance and passion and all those things. And mm-hmm. what's your sense in terms of how they relate to the overall big purposeful goals that you set yourself?
Well, I think you need a purpose in order to understand why you're doing what you're doing. And then the next part is to figure out how you can be as consistent as possible working towards those things. You're not necessarily passionate about everything from the beginning, right? So at least one way that you can start to cultivate passion is by cultivating a smaller curiosity. So if you're interested in something, it doesn't mean that everything else has to stop and you're going to work on this the whole time and you're going to just like risk it. That works for very few people. In my own experience, I think what's important is like to cultivate the things that naturally draw you out into the world, things that you're interested in, and not to beat yourself up for not being this incredibly passionate individual who, you know, you see on TV and then the movies and, you know, these artists or and creatives or, you know, these maniacs that do these incredibly dramatic things in order to do what they love. That's very rare. I feel like, and I think we judge ourselves by that. It's like, I don't have that, you know? Does that mean I just don't care about anything? And I feel like that's not true either. There's a spectrum of curiosity. Mm-hmm. On one end, it's kind of like, that's interesting. And on the other end, it's, you know, cutting off your ear. You know, there's a big gamut. And I think it starts, but we can cultivate that. Because at the beginning, when you're curious about something, it promises meaning, right? There's something there. You don't know what, but it's calling you. And that probably means that you think that it might reveal some truth or purpose or meaning. but it's going to take a while to get there. So I feel like you just start by figuring out how you can spend a little bit more time to cultivate your curiosity without taking any dramatic measure. And over time, as you begin to learn more about this subject matter, you start to zero in on the thing that does interest you. And I feel like the closer you get to that, the more passionate you can become as you start to realize what it is that is actually holding your interest, the thing that it actually appeals to you. And that takes time and it takes work. And I think it's not an all or nothing pursuit. Like, start with little projects. You know, you're interested about playing guitar or cooking or something. It's like, okay, well, start with, you know, 10 minutes a day, something like that, and you work towards it. And then in my own experience, one of two things happens, right? You learn more about it and you realize, actually, it's not that interesting, or it was a short-lived curiosity, which is fine. And then you can go back, get back to your life. Mm-hmm. Or then there's the other part, right? Where all of a sudden you realize there's something here. And I want more of it, and I want to understand more about it, and I want to learn more about it. And then because you have started the process of learning, you will know where to start to direct your efforts and continue to cultivate your curiosity. Of course, if you're super passionate about something, then you have to figure out how you can spend the most amount of time doing that without sabotaging the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. And that becomes the challenge, right? It's like, I need to pay my bills, but all I want to do is play guitar all day long.
Yeah.
So how do you navigate that? And that's also a process of, you know, taking small steps of figuring out how to be able to spend as much time with the thing that you believe in and less time with the things that you don't.
Okay. Final thing. What's next for Ryder Carroll?
There are a lot of fun projects in the work right now that I'm really excited about, but I think that what drives me most is figuring out how to be able to become a better teacher. Hmm. You know, in this one subject in the world, I am the authority, and I'm deeply honored to have this opportunity, so I want to make the most of it. So what does that look like? Well, the bullet journal in many ways is a blank page, and that can be very intimidating to people. Like, what I say is it can become whatever you need it to be, but what if you don't know what you need it to be yet? So we've started working on different programs to be able to target the application of the bullet journal method more specifically. So we've done bullet journaling for parents and bullet journaling for project managers and stuff like that. And I would like to continue to create educational material that helps people see how they can apply it in their own lives.
Do you have bullet journal for presidents? Just saying. But, well, I really appreciate your time again. Thanks very much, Ryder.
Thank you for having me.
I look forward to following your journey over the next 10, 15 years and seeing where this goes.
Well, thank you kindly, and thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Okay, folks, that's it for this week. If you like the show, please subscribe, and ideally give us a 5-star rating and a review, because it helps more people discover us. Just go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to subscribe and rate. For now, stay curious, be creative, and be open to serendipity. See you next time.